It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickard are off today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, whether you've been driving for decades or are the proud new owner of a learner's permit, the James Bond stunt driver has advice for you on being a better, safer driver. First, an update on the story of Lincoln Hills School for Boys, which we've been tracking for several months. The youth prison and its sister institution, the Copper Lake School for Girls, are both under federal investigation for allegations of prisoner abuse, child neglect, excessive use of pepper spray, destruction of records, and misconduct in office. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has made several requests for prison documents and videos, but Governor Scott Walker's administration has failed to provide records or denied several requests over the last several months. Patrick Marley just reported on these requests, and he's with us to share the details. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
So what kind of information and prison documents is Governor Walker's administration withholding?
Well, we can't get any video at all. The state law is restrictive on releasing documents about juveniles. These inmates are primarily people 18 or younger, so I'm a little bit older than that. And so they've just made a blanket decision. They won't release any videos. So that's been one point of frustration. There are many other documents we've asked for, paper documents, and have had to wait a very long time for some of them and have been denied many of them outright.
Well, we will break down those records that the Journal Sentinel has requested, but going back to the videos, I mean, we often see videos on the news or on other kinds of television shows that where the faces are blurred, so someone is not actually recognizable. Would that not be an option?
They have not offered that option to us. We have been seeking some video from adult institutions, and in the past, or more recent than these requests, the department has, at least in one occasion I know of, released video from one of its adult institutions. It's citing a law that's specific to juveniles in state custody in saying that it can't release them about videos. We haven't actually approached them about the possibility of blurring faces. That's one thing we've wondered about, but we haven't formally asked the department if they would consider that.
So let's break down and go through the records the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has requested. You've asked for documents relating to employees who are put on paid leave, and those were requested in December. Where is that request at?
So this is a very frustrating thing. We feel that sort of one of the most basic pieces of information people should be able to know about their government is who's on the payroll and what they're being paid to do. The department put a number of people on what's called administrative leave, which is paid leave while they're investigated for any kind of workplace infractions. And so we asked early on when we learned of all the problems at Lincoln Hills for a list of the employees who were on paid leave, when they went on paid leave, and what their pay was. The department refused to release this information. They since have said that they will release it, but they have not yet done so. This is a request from 6 months ago. We're asking for the most basic information, which is how much are taxpayers paying employees to not work.
And so are these employees who are still on the payroll but are on paid leave right now?
That's right. These are all, at least at the time of the request, these were employees who were unpaid leave while they were investigated. Now, some of these people were cleared and put back to work with no discipline. They never did anything wrong. They were just checked out. Other people were ultimately fired, and during the time that they were investigated, they were on paid leave. We know of one case that speaks to how slow some of these investigations can move that was on paid leave for a year and then was ultimately fired. And this guy says that he did not do anything wrong. The department came to a different conclusion, but you know, the employees describe a very tenuous feeling while they're in this situation, because on the one hand they don't have to do any work and they get paid, but every moment of every day they're worried about losing their job, and many of them feel that they didn't do anything wrong and are, you know, in kind of a rough emotional state while they wait their fate.
Mm-hmm. Another request that the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel made was for documentation about 2 years of reports on fights that happened in the correctional facilities. What's the status of that?
We've modified that request. We've had a lot of difficulty getting that. It would seem to be a pretty basic thing to just give us all the reports on fights. You know, anything you've labeled as a fight in the last 2 years at this institution, they told us that that was so difficult to do that it would severely burden the operations of the Department of Corrections. It turns out, we later reported, that they have no central electronic tracking system for incidents at Lincoln Hills, unlike a database they have for adult institutions that monitors things that have happened there. They don't have that for the juvenile system. So everything's kept on paper. We have since been, we were initially denied these records about fights. Later they told us, after we fought it, that they could provide them, but that it would cost us $1,100 in staff time just to find where the records were. And so what we've done is asked for a subset of those 2 years of records to see what kind of records we'd be getting before we invest that kind of money for them.
We're talking with Patrick Marley right now. He is a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about records requests that the Journal Sentinel has filed, especially in relation to the Lincoln Hills Juvenile Correction Facility. Now, Patrick, going back to videos, so there is this issue about video just uniformly being denied. A couple of videos, it would seem, are of fairly serious situations. One is a video of a cell where a 33-year-old inmate died at the Oshkosh Correctional Institution. That would be someone who is not a minor. And then there's also a video of an April incident in which Lincoln Hills inmate said he waited for guards while his roommate was attempting suicide and that the guards took a long time. Is there any way to get information about those incidents that would not involve the video, which they're saying they'll never release?
Well, so for the person, the adult who was found in his cell, they have denied that for the moment, in part because of a pending investigation. I don't think that they've closed the door to never releasing that one. It is possible that that one would come out. At the juvenile institution, I think we have a much greater challenge that I think the department is going to stand by its argument, as we discussed earlier, for not releasing videos of juveniles. There are, you know, we put in other requests for paper documents. Presumably, we will learn more about that from that. However, you know, you can't underestimate the value of video and what it shows. The, you know, this incident where this one youth tried to commit suicide and his roommate held him up. There's a dispute with the youth who held up the other inmate, saying there was a very long time before staff responded to his cries for help as he tried to save this other kid's life, and the staff is saying that they responded in a timely manner. Mm-hmm. Well, video would show us exactly how many seconds elapsed or minutes elapsed before that happened.
So all of these responses or lacks of responses from the Department of Corrections come at a time when Governor Scott Walker is calling for more transparency. How does this fit into that new mandate that he has put into place?
So in March, the governor issued an executive order that was to all agencies like the Department of Corrections that his administration is responsible for to better track their open records requests, respond to them as timely as they can. I think it's also important to note that the Department of Corrections has a new secretary as of February, which is John Litcher, replacing Ed Wall. So the Department of Corrections says it's getting things in order and is being more responsive, and that some of the many delays we've faced are because we've made a lot of requests, and we've made requests for large volumes of documents. And they say that these can be large and complex. You know, that many times they have to black out the names of juveniles. In all cases, they have to black out health information about inmates or staff. So they say that they're doing this in the way that the law allows, which the law says it's supposed to be as soon as practicable and without delay. I think the disagreement would be what's an acceptable delay in waiting for records.
As we wrap up, Patrick, what would you say the next steps that the Journal Sentinel will take will be, and how hopeful are you that you will eventually get at least most of the information that you've requested?
Well, you know, we're journalists. We always want more information. We're always looking to get, you know, we're not satisfied unless we get every last thing we want. But, you know, as we prepared this story, the department late on Friday, just before our deadline, gave us a number of records that we'd been seeking for a couple of months. We'll continue to make requests. We'll continue to pester them about the ones that we have made, and we'll report on them as we find them out. I mean, I think it's really case by case. You know, some of these are no-brainers that we're going to get. Some of them are going to be a tough fight, and others will be in this gray area where we'll have to, we'll have to make our case to the department.
Well, Patrick, thanks so much for being with us. We'll definitely watch for follow-ups on this.
All right, thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about his latest piece about how Governor Scott Walker's administration is withholding prison records and videos. You can find a link to his piece that outlines all of the requests that they've made and when on the Central Time Facebook page. Just search for Central Time on WPR. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, the current political environment could make it seem like there's a lot wrong with our nation and world right now, but many factors actually indicate room for optimism. We'll look into why being positive has fallen out of favor. Right now, if you've ever watched a chase scene in an action movie, you've probably been impressed with the level of expertise that the drivers have. It takes a lot of skill and daring to do that kind of job and to do it well. Our next guest has been in love with cars from an early age, and that passion led him to a career first as a Formula One race car driver and now as a stunt driver in Hollywood movies like the current James Bond series. Ben Collins wants to share what he's learned as a stunt driver with the rest of us so that we can all be better, safer drivers. His book is How to Drive, Real World Instruction and Advice from Hollywood's Top Driver. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So, in your opinion, as a professional driver, what causes the most car crashes?
Well, there are lots of different types of crashes. I guess the ones we care about most are the ones that are the most life-threatening, but most accidents kind of happen at intersections where people bump into each other and get out and exchange details and maybe get angry, but nobody really gets hurt. But the accidents we really, I suppose, worry about are where, you know, we're going to end up hurting somebody. So in cities, it's running over pedestrians or cyclists, but really where the driver and the vehicle occupant is most likely to get hurt is on the open road out. In rural roads where you get the twisty stuff, you get the serious weather, hydroplane, all those things that can take you by surprise. And you need to be on your A game and really know how to drive if you want to tackle those challenges.
And you talk about thinking distance in relation to avoiding crashes. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a lot of distractions in the world these days, notably the mobile phone. So the thinking distance is the time it takes for you to work out what to do when a situation unfolds in front of you. And if you're staring down into the footwell or concentrating on something you've just pulled from your nose or reaching for a glove box snack, your thinking time could take a long time. I mean, you may even hit the thing in front of you before you've actually reacted to it. So thinking distance or thinking time, which obviously unfolds as distance because you're traveling at speed, that's what that means. And then your body has to put a plan together, and you need to think quite quickly about what to do. And my view is, if you're pre-armed with the right information and you know what to do in certain situations, then your response is a lot more true and a lot more likely to save your bacon when you need it.
And you talk in your book, How to Drive, about being a race driver and traveling at these incredibly high speeds that hopefully most of us are never going to reach, and how you're thinking so far down the road, literally, and what could possibly happen. How do we take some of those lessons in thinking ahead and preparing ourselves for anything that might happen?
Well, I feel sorry for my parents, really, because I'm sure they must have looked at me staggering through the door with the wrong colored socks on or whatever, in a complete shambles when I was younger, and think this guy is just going to be, he's going to crash into something. And sure enough, I did, because I just didn't see the risks, and that's part of the problem. And is looking physically further ahead down the road is the first step to thinking ahead. With racing, I learned very quickly that to control speed, you have to look further forward. And it was a skill that any racing driver, from Mario Andretti to Dale Jr., all these guys deploy that skill, because looking further ahead gives you a lot more time to plan what's coming next and to think about it. And with races, we kind of we make simulations in our head. We imagine how these races will go weeks in advance and really try and make a plan. That's something that you can easily learn for the road day to day. It's just about using your imagination. You know, what could come around this corner? What might happen next? That dog's not on a leash. Is it going to run in front of me? Will the owner chase the dog and end up underneath my wheels? So it's just about switching on that great asset that we all have, which is the human brain. It's an unbelievable piece of technology, and it's irreplaceable.
I don't know if you spent much time in the upper Midwest, especially in the winter, but we do spend a lot of time driving in winter weather conditions here. What are some of the tips that we should keep in mind to be safe given potentially icy roads, snow, things like deer running across the road?
I mean, America has, I think, some of the toughest driving conditions in the world. Everybody commutes often long distances to work. Driving is part of American culture because it's how the country was founded. It literally fuels the economy. So everybody gets involved with that at some point. And also the landscape and the weather, like you say, can be pretty aggressive. And it can change very, very quickly. I've seen hail the size of golf balls that could smash windscreens just come out of nowhere. When it rains, you know, if you've had a nice dry spell in the summer, the surface of the tarmac, or even the concrete in some cases, it gets very shiny, kind of polished. And at that point, when the rain hits it, it's very, very easy for the puddles to form, and you can expect hydroplane at that point. So that's when you hit a big piece of water, and it can lift the wheels off the ground. So being observant when you think, okay, it hasn't rained for a long time, and when it does rain, it's going to pool faster than normal. But the real challenge is winter, like you say, snow and ice. And the trick with that is just, again, to think ahead of, you know, you can see, hopefully most cars will tell you when you've gone sub-zero and when to expect ice. And there's a lot of, I could spend hours talking through how you control it, but really the first thing is being aware that the surface has changed, because when the surface freezes, it's like being on another planet. Gravity and the laws of friction have completely gone upside down, and you need to drive in a much different way, be much more careful with the controls, much smoother, more gentle, and plan especially braking earlier.
We have something that happens here called black ice, and you can't see it until you hit it, and then all of a sudden your car is sliding uncontrollably. When you're in that moment, the adrenaline is all of a sudden spiking. What's the most important thing to do as you feel like you're losing control of your car?
Again, the most important thing is try to preempt that. If you feel cold when you get in the car, then the tires are going to feel cold too, and they're going to be harder. And again, that temperature readout, it's really important. If it's showing that it's near zero, you know, less than sort of 7 degrees, then you should expect ice. In that moment when you hit black ice, and there's lots of places again you can try to predict, like you know, freeways that go over a big overpass where there's air underneath, like bridges, places like that, they get super cold, colder than the surrounding roads, and they will freeze much faster in the night. So again, it's trying to observe for those things. But in the moment, when it hits, one thing that's strange with black ice, the road noise will suddenly stop. It'll go very, very quiet. That's a telltale that you're on ice. But when it goes and you hit that surface, you're into another world of car control, and it's a case of trying to recover grip as well as you can, and for the, you know, for that moment of terror to end. So you've got when the back of the car is sliding, you can steer into the skid. If the car starts spinning, really, if you really have lost control, all you can do is hit the brakes as hard as you can and try and take some speed off and hope you don't hit something.
We're talking with Ben Collins. He's a champion racer and sought-after stunt driver. His new book is How to Drive, Real-World Instruction and Advice from Hollywood's Top Driver. You are a stunt driver and a very sought-after one. You have been the James Bond stunt driver in the last three 007 movies. What are some of the crazier don't-try-this-at-home stunts that you've driven?
I've loved working on those films, and the first one I worked on was Quantum of Solace, and we had a crazy car chase around a lake with a kind of cliff fall on one side and a solid piece of mountain on the other. And my job was to work on that car chase involved driving on the wrong side of the road when you couldn't see around the corner, passing trucks and other traffic, knowing that there was a truck heading the other way, and we had split second, literally feet to miss hitting it and to nip back into the right side of the road. That's probably not something I'd do on my lunch break. If I wasn't being paid to do it, I wouldn't have done it. But I loved it. We were driving at very high speeds through tunnels. I think I clocked 165 miles an hour or so at some point during that chase. But I love it. It's what I've been trained to do. And we make every effort to make these chases as safe as possible, but to make them look as spectacular as possible. And the beauty of the James Bond movies is that they don't use CGI, no computer graphics. It's all real action. It's always a real person on the end of the line or in the car. So I think that's what audiences really engage with.
It's certainly exciting to be watching, and especially to know that what you're seeing really happened and that a real human being like you made it happen.
That's it, yeah. I think it's crucial. And, you can see that more now in the behind the scenes and in DVDs. They're showing more and more how the stunts are made, and it's really incredible. I do the driving, but I've learned to have huge respect for the guys that do the martial arts, the fight sequences, jumping off buildings. They really are at an unbelievable level now. It's super professional.
Ben Collins, thanks so much for joining us today. Ben Collins is a Formula One race car driver and is now a stunt driver in Hollywood movies like the current James Bond franchise. He's the author of How to Drive, Real World Instruction and Advice from Hollywood's Top Driver. Coming up after the news, we look at when the tide turned to make optimism seem naive, even when many indicators show that things are better than ever. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we talk about today's Supreme Court decision not to hear challenges to state assault weapons bans. First, listening to politicians, reading the news, or chatting with friends and neighbors, it may seem like we're in a time of unprecedented doom and gloom. But looking at the data, the United States is in better shape now and moving, for the most part, in positive directions. So why aren't we feeling better about life? Greg Easterbrook is a contributing editor of The Atlantic. He's the author of The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse, and of a recent New York Times opinion piece, When Did Optimism Become Uncool? Greg, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Judith.
Well, let's start with that premise, that things are not nearly as bad as we think they are. What would you point to? Maybe start with the economy.
Well, think about what we hear in public debate, Donald Trump saying the country is going to hell and so on. Then look at the data. Economically, unemployment is unusually low in historic terms and almost as low as it was during what we now think of as the golden age in the late 1990s. Growth is mild, but still we've had five straight years of expanding GDP and expanding jobs. Living standards have never been higher. The secondary indicators of living standards are all positive. Longevity is increasing. Most diseases are declining. Most forms of pollution are declining. Crime is in a long-term cycle of decline. Almost everything that you can measure objectively about the sociological condition of the country is in the best shape that it's ever been in. And yet we're all so negative about the country's situation.
Right. You reference in your New York Times piece an April Gallup poll that found that only slightly over one quarter of Americans call themselves satisfied with, quote, the way things are going in the United States. So how do you explain that disconnect?
Well, I think social science research shows that a lot of what people's feelings of life satisfaction and similar, whatever touchy-feely way you want to use to describe it, a lot of people's feelings about this are not so much concerned with their current objective condition, but what they expect will happen next. So if your current condition is a difficult one, but you think that life is going to get better 5 years from now, you feel pretty good. Whereas if your current condition is reasonably good, but you think that life is arcing downward, then you express the kind of negative feelings that we see in society today. The Gallup poll that you mentioned, Judith, the last time it showed that a majority of Americans thought the country was headed in a positive direction was 12 years ago in the first term of the younger President Bush. So we've had 12 straight years where Americans think things are about to get worse. It hasn't happened. I can't guarantee you that it will never happen, but the expected getting worse of the country hasn't occurred. In general, not everything, of course, but in general, most things continue to improve. But we seem to be convinced that things are just about to get worse, and I think that has a lot to do with the mood of the country.
So one statistic that you quote that I think really sums up that disconnect between the reality of life today and perceptions is that even taking into account September 11th, an American is five times more likely to be hit by lightning than to be killed by a terrorist. But yet terrorism is a very real, palpable fear, and the battle against it is a high priority for many Americans. So just looking at that one statistic, where does the idea of terrorism looming large over our daily lives come from? How does it have that staying power?
Well, terrorism is horrible. What happened in Orlando? 49 people gunned down. Your mind can't get around what a horrible thought that is. Not just something that's morally wrong and that threatens the country, and just try to imagine what that scene must have been like. And if you counter that by saying, "But the odds of this happening to me are far less than one in a million," that in that case you're juxtaposing emotion versus logic, and emotion is always going to win. But I think one reason that there are two reasons that we focus so much on terrorism. One is that politicians talk about it endlessly, for good or ill. It's a favorite topic of politicians. And secondly, we live in a news cycle world that's dominated by cable networks and social networks, both of which drastically exaggerate anything wrong. They oversell anger. They create the impression that what's going on all around the world every day is Orlando after Orlando, when in fact, right now, not just for the United States, but for the whole world, any resident anywhere in the world, your chances of dying by violence right now are the lowest they've been in human history, and they are noticeably lower than they were even just 25 years ago.
And you say in your New York Times opinion piece, going back to those political messages that then the 24-hour news cycle picks up and repeats and repeats and repeats, you say this election season, the impending apocalypse has been issue number one for presidential aspirants on both sides. Let's start with the Republicans. What messages were they putting out when the field was still crowded with contenders and they were trying to jockey for position?
Well, it wasn't just saying Donald Trump saying that the country's going to hell, and Trump constantly says we're losing all the time. I don't know what country he's talking about, because all the rest of the world thinks that we're winning all the time. But Ted Cruz said the United States is near an abyss. Now, this is technically true, since there is a physical abyss in the Gulf of Mexico, but he meant that the country was going to fall into some sort of biblical abyss. Marco Rubio, when he was still in the race, said, "I don't know if the United States has 4 years left before it ceases to exist." Lindsey Graham, when he was running for president, said that the world is falling to pieces. You look out the window and you don't see any evidence of this, but it makes a good political appeal, because politicians, especially at the early stage when they're seeking donations, they're looking for zealous followers who are willing to provide both time and money, and creating a sense that there's some sort of apocalypse in play. And as the very wise Warren Buffett says, politicians always want to create that sense, because then you need to give power and money to politicians. If things are basically fine, you can trust your community to take care of it. I think that was a big factor in the Republican run-up, but it was not exclusive to Republicans. Bernie Sanders talks about the economy like the world is ending, when average people are not completely happy, of course, with their conditions, but have statistically never been better off than they are today.
So you say that, especially when there was this field of 17 contenders, you know, people were trying to kind of out-tough each other on the Republican side. Now that it looks like Donald Trump will be the nominee, or maybe someone will come out of the woodwork at the convention, but looking pretty strong for Donald Trump, is there any chance that he will go away from that very negative, we're in dire straits kind of position, or is that his bread and butter right now?
Well, it sure trying to understand the mental processes of Donald Trump is, I think, a losing game for everyone, probably including him. Certainly in the last century, with the exception of during Depression, World War II, and a couple of the dark years of the Cold War, most American national leaders have tried to emphasize an optimistic view of the country's future. And that's certainly what I take. I have three children. I think they've been born at a wonderful time. I think 2016 is the best year ever in the United States. 2017 will be better still. And the easy mental test of it was, seriously, what year in the past would you rather live in than today? But this curious change of nothing but negative rhetoric on the overall larger national political scene, I think it's driven by cable news and social media, where the point that I tried to make in that New York Times piece is that today, if you're an optimist, you're viewed as a Pollyanna. You know that saying, if you don't understand, if you're not upset about the situation, then you don't understand the situation. People who take optimistic views are not Pollyannas. It doesn't mean that they deny that there are problems. Of course, there are all kinds of problems. The optimists think the problems can be fixed. And when I look at the United States, I see climate change, inequality, racial tension. There's plenty of problems. But as an optimist, I think we can fix all those problems. And the sort of negative reactionary worldview that's promoted by Trump and also by Bernie Sanders would only take us backwards to a place that we don't want to go.
We're talking with Greg Easterbrook about his recent New York Times opinion piece, When Did Optimism Become Uncool? He's also the author of The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse. And you've pointed to Bernie Sanders. Hillary Clinton also has had some negative messages out there. And I think you make a really interesting point about liberals and progressives in your opinion piece. You say that their traditional role in U.S. politics has been to be the sunny optimists who are tempered by the more realistic and negative conservatives. And so now the balance between the two that was pretty crucial to U.S. politics has been thrown off. So, Greg, what does it mean now that both parties and all of their wings seem to be squarely in the pessimist camp?
Well, think about the history of this. In Wisconsin, you're in one of the birthplaces of the progressive movement of roughly a century ago. And the progressives of that time, progressive with a capital P, they were the optimists. They thought that life could be made better and the average person could live a much more fulfilling, much better educated life. The conservatives of the time, all their worldview boiled down to the word harumph. They thought the judgment day was coming and trying to improve society was pointless. Well, now the left thinks the judgment day is coming too. Conservatives still think that. Donald Trump is the best expression, but the left thinks that nature is about to collapse and that society is horrible and that the days of Jim Crow are back and we're all going to be starving in the streets. It's a huge bundle of nonsense, but it's a bundle of nonsense that gets people to donate money. And I think that's what underlies a lot of this.
We're talking with Greg Easterbrook right now. He's the author of The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse, and of a recent New York Times opinion piece, When Did Optimism Become Uncool? And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Would you say that you are generally optimistic or pessimistic about life in the United States right now? Whichever way you feel, where do you think that comes from? Does it match how you would describe yourself as a person generally? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation after this short break here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we talk about the Supreme Court's decision to not hear guns rights advocates' challenges to state bans on assault weapons. Right now, we're continuing the conversation with Greg Easterbrook about the negativity and pessimism of the American public and its political leaders in the face of much evidence that points to reasons for optimism. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Would you say that you're generally pessimistic or optimistic about your own life and the state of the country and the directions it's heading in? Whichever way you feel, where do you think those thoughts and feelings come from? Do you want your political leaders to be more positive, or do you think that their pessimism is warranted? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Greg, I thought it was really interesting that you published your book, The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse, in 2004. So clearly this is not a new phenomenon.
No, it's not. I was working on that book in the late 90s, actually, and that's when the book came out. So it's now a dozen years ago, and I felt that was a keen factor in American life then, and this was before the term social network existed. And I think it's gotten a stronger grip on American thinking today. There's a number of reasons we can think of. One is the structure of media and how media complaints exist. Another is the sort of balkanization of American politics, the growth of us versus them political movements. And if you want it to be us versus them, you always want them to be horrible, terrible people with nefarious motives who must be stopped. I think it's real interesting when you look at poll data. When pollsters, Gallup and others, the University of Chicago and so on, when they ask people what they think about the condition of the country, for a decade consistently they've been saying, oh, things are terrible. And then you ask them what's the condition of your own community, the place where you live, the schools, the police, etc. Oh, things are great in my town. So people think that by pretty big majorities, people think that things that they can see with their own eyes are good, but that the larger world is falling apart. That's because what's the interpreter of the larger world for most people? It's CNN and Fox News, where there's flashing red and everything is negative and anger is overstated. And in a world of now we're up to almost 7 billion people, in a world of 7 billion people, there will always be something that's burning, exploding, sinking. And if all you see when you turn on your communications media is horror over whatever's burning or exploding at that moment, you may conclude that everything's burning and exploding. And that was kind of one of the founding insights of that book, The Progress Paradox. And I think to the extent that I was accurate in understanding the national mood, it's gotten worse since.
Let's go to the phones, and Frank in Wausau is up. Hi, Frank.
Hi. I'd like your speaker's thoughts on the $19 trillion debt that's being talked about. That makes me pessimistic, but how do you view it, and if you can speak to that?
Thanks, Frank. And Greg, what would you say?
Well, I have three kids, and when I talk to them, I tell them the long-term things that I worry about for their lifetime. I don't worry about climate change. Climate change is real. It's scientifically proven, but it's also an engineering problem, and Americans are really good at solving engineering problems. So I think climate change can be solved if we do the right things. I worry about developing world poverty a lot because it involves such huge numbers of people. Now, you'd never know this, but all the trend lines are positive. If you take the World Bank figures a quarter of a century ago, 40% of the world lived in extreme destitution. It's now down to 10%, and the global population has increased in that period. But we've still got a billion people in the world living in dire circumstances, and that's changing that as a gigantic project. And I tell my kids I worry about the national debt. We've borrowed without restraint in the last decade, not just in the Obama years, to the last 3 years of the younger George Bush administration, too. Beginning in 2006, if you adjust to current dollars, we've borrowed more money than in all the previous years of our republic combined. And anybody who's run a household knows that you can borrow like crazy for a brief time. You can order champagne when you're at the restaurant. If you just do it for a brief time, it's okay. But if you do it all the time, things fall apart. So I would say probably the biggest threat to two biggest threats to our economy, certainly it's not competition with China. I think that's highly overrated, but I worry about national debt, and I worry it is certainly possible that the Luddites will eventually be proven right, and automation will take away too many jobs.
Well, I wonder if that idea about the national debt hanging over us is part of that sense of, you know, it's only downhill from here. Like, we're not seeing in our everyday lives the impact of that huge national debt, but, you know, the it's going to come home to roost eventually.
You know, I almost wish, Judith, that you were right about that. Polling data shows that if you talk to political consultants about why debt isn't a bigger issue in any campaign, they all say, because debt doesn't poll. In other words, voters don't care about it. Mm-hmm. Voters care about, can I get more benefits today? We had last week President Obama saying that even with the Social Security system facing a liquidity crisis pretty soon, he wants to increase benefits because everybody wants higher benefits today. I wish people worried more about debt. It's certainly not an unsolvable problem. It's a problem that can be managed. But it's very ungracious, to put it mildly, if I'm a baby boomer, of our generation to be borrowing all this money and handing the bill to our children.
Let's go back to the phones, and Nick in Eagle River is up. Hi, Nick.
Hi there. And actually, I'm from Eagle River, but my wife and I are driving through beautiful Wisconsin, enjoying your program.
Great. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to express my concern about the fact that those who benefit, whether it be politicians in the form of votes or sometimes media in the form of sponsorship, that benefit from sensationalism and talking about the negative side and blowing it out of proportion and actually fooling people, as you said earlier, into thinking that our economy is not doing as well as it really is. I think that we really have a sad energy level in this country that tends to draw and feed on negativism. And I think that we need to inspire our children and generations to come with the notion that a positive attitude and looking at where we're doing well. I think we need to have more programs on the good things that are going on around us rather than focusing on all the negative, because we are moving in a positive direction.
Thanks for that call, Nick. And actually, Greg, one of the things I wanted to bring up with you that fits in well with what Nick was just saying is that it seems like one of the draws of Ronald Reagan was his enduring optimism and how positive he felt about the country and what this country is all about. So will there ever be room for another Ronald Reagan in that sense of being kind of the nation's cheerleader?
Well, I sure wish we had more politicians with Reagan's instinct about that. He wasn't a perfect president, but when he said that it was still morning in America, he was right. I think it's still morning in America today. Maybe it's 11:45 in America, but it's definitely still morning. The country is on an upswing. All the things that are wrong with the country, and there are many things, they're all fixable. There's nothing going on that we can't deal with it, and that if we're willing to work on it. And for me, the key thing that I think was just alluded to by your caller is optimism is the best argument for reform. If you want to deal with climate change, if you want to deal with inequality, deal with them from a standpoint of optimism. We should try to fix these problems because the fix will succeed and the country will become even better. If you're negative, if you think that the world's going to hell, then I guess we really should build walls around the country like Donald Trump thinks. But if you think optimistically, if you think that reforms will work, then you want to tackle global warming, racial tension, etc., because 10 years from now, things will be better.
So in your opinion piece in the New York Times, you quote billionaire investor Warren Buffett, who you mentioned earlier, as blaming the negative drumbeat of politics for the fact that, quote, many Americans now believe their children will not live as well as they themselves do. That view is dead wrong. The babies being born in America today are the luckiest crop in history. One of the things that I thought about reading your piece, Greg, is that those babies and children and young people right now are hearing all of the negative views and perspectives that we've been talking about. Is there a risk that they'll be swayed by that as their parents and grandparents seem to be?
Well, since children always reject whatever they're taught, I guess we shouldn't worry about that too much. No, I think kids can see through, kids and young people generally, I mean more young people can see through the nonsense they're being told by the political system. I think that's why there's so much cynicism. about politics, but I think it's important, and I hope the young people can make this distinction, to distinguish between thinking that the United States should have 3% GDP growth every year, which was the average from the end of World War II to about 1995. I don't think that's realistic. I don't think it's even necessary to have GDP growth at that level. But it is realistic to think that our society can become ever more tolerant, more open, people will be better educated, crime and disease will keep declining, that the country can keep being a better place. That's
Greg, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for being with us. Greg Easterbrook is the author of a recent New York Times opinion piece, When Did Optimism Become Uncool? You can find a link to it on the Central Time Facebook page. Well, it's the summer solstice, which means that it's the longest day of the year. Sometimes it seems like it must be a mean trick to have it fall on a Monday like it did this time around. Well, depending on where you are in Wisconsin, you'll enjoy between 15 and 15 and a half hours of sunlight today. Plus, the solstice also gives us the longest twilight of the year, and that's usually about 1 to 1.5 extra hours after sunset. Well, when I was living in Russia many years ago, I happened to travel way north right around the summer solstice, so I experienced what they call white nights. The darkest it got all night was kind of a twilight, which was really disorienting. Pretty cool to experience, but I don't think I'd want to have it be that way all summer. I guess it's the little kid in me, but I would always feel like I was missing out on something. Well, if you have plans to make use of that extra sunlight today, we'd love to hear about them. Go over to the Central Time Facebook page and tell us what you've got planned. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we talk about the Supreme Court's refusal today to hear cases that challenge bans on assault weapons. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, I'm so happy that I can flip. Oh, how I'd love to take a trip. I'm sorry.